Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument in the interest of OGM, from petitioner.
May it please the court. Ms. Lynn Liberato will represent the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. I am Lynn Liberato, and along with Earl Lilly, I represent Milford Schmidt. Mr. Lilly will be presenting the rebuttal.
Let me ask you, just right from the start, if the statute she rely on don't apply, just assume with me that the statutes don't apply in this situation. Is it your position that parents can terminate parental rights orally?
Is it our position that parents can terminate?
Terminate parental rights by oral agreement before birth?
By oral, but that wouldn't apply here because there would be no parental rights to begin with.
Well, you don't contest that he's the biological father, correct?
Well, there's no dispute he's the biological father. We don't dispute that. The question is whether he's the donor or the husband. He's not either one.
Well, no, I said absent the statute. Let's say the statute's
outside
done upon.
The statute.
Then if he's the biological father, I don't understand the distinction between biological father and parent outside the statutory context. Maybe help me with that.
For him to be a parent, I think that it has to be considered in the context that this is an assisted conception status.
So you're saying that then without if the statute did not apply, then you would concede that biological father is the same as parent?
Well, not in an assisted conception case. I see what you're saying, but I think that's part of the problem in here. Because I think that what that shows and the import of that question is it shows that the statutes have to apply in this kind of a situation.
So,
because there's a limbo.
You want to address the possibility then of if we don't find they apply.
Well, if you don't find that the statutes apply, then these parties had an oral agreement. And then our position is, and I think this is consistent with what the general law is that an oral agreement is enforceable and that oral agreement can be enforced and that it has to be sent back, though, to the trial court.
But Ms. Liberato, in Texas, what is the nature of this oral agreement?
The nature of the oral agreement would be how the embryo, who's going to have parental rights over the embryo.
Well, and isn't the effect of the oral agreement, as your client presents it, that her former husband would voluntarily then be relinquishing his parental rights?
Well, assuming he had them, but that's
assuming
correct.
Assuming that they did, that would be the effect.
That would be the effect.
Now, doesn't the Texas Family Code provide for under what circumstances parental rights can be voluntarily relinquished?
Well, but you have to start with the presumption, understanding that he is has parental rights.
Well, but we're putting that aside.
Okay.
Okay, let's say you lose on the argument that Chapter 151 applies. And we know that he is the biological father.
Correct.
And you're asking us to enforce an oral agreement.
Correct.
That would result in the voluntary relinquishment of his parental rights.
Right.
Doesn't the Texas Family Code provide that parental rights cannot be voluntarily relinquished before birth, and that when they are voluntarily relinquished, they have to be done in accordance with the statute?
They do, but it's just such a different circumstance here. And the circumstance is so different is that that this isn't a situation where the general principles can apply because of the specific circumstances whenever you have
But again, we need to stay with the
okay.
Chapter 151 doesn't apply.
Okay.
I want to see where that leaves us if it doesn't apply.
Okay.
Where does that leave us? Is the alleged oral agreement enforceable under Texas law?
Yes.
Why?
Because they had an agreement because an agreement can be enforced, but I understand your question. Your question is, does the family code, under a normal circumstance, if this was a situation where the husband or a man and a woman through intercourse created a child, then could the father or the mother relinquish parental rights? And the answer to that is no.
As a matter of public policy, wouldn't it make sense to have these kind of agreements in writing?
Absolutely. But, of course, they're not always in writing, and here's a specific example of a case where it's not in writing.
Can we talk about 151, why it applies?
Sure. Well, 151 applies because it's under there are many reasons. But one is that it's under the general category of assisted conception. So if it's going to fit anywhere, it's going to have to fit under there. But quite frankly, it seems to me, and our position, of course, is that it does apply under 151.101, which is the artificial insemination statute, that there's really not very much difference between artificial insemination from a legal standpoint, between artificial insemination and implantation of an embryo. In artificial insemination, the sperm is directly introduced into the uterus of the woman. In an in vitro fertilization situation, the sperm is joined in a petri dish with the egg, and then that is introduced into the woman's uterus. So from a legal standpoint, it's still insemination. Now, I understand that from a scientific standpoint, it's much more complicated.
Well, in fact, at the time the statute was enacted, 101 was enacted.
Right.
In fact, in vitro fertilization had not been yet accomplished successfully.
That's right.
So how could the legislature have contemplated that artificial insemination included in vitro fertilization when science had not yet shown that it was possible?
Well, that's exactly right. And, of course, that's the situation we have here. The law is really struggling to keep pace with scientific advances.
But the legislature came back in and added 102 and 103 at a later point in time to deal with additional scientific developments. So how can we read 101 to cover in vitro fertilization under those circumstances?
Well, I think there's two parts to that answer. Number one, we can't even contemplate what might be happening a year from now or 2 years from now because of the quick advances in technology and for the law to try to be keeping up with it. That's one of the things that the court has to do, is that the courts have to interpret these statutes. And, of course, that's what we're asking this court to do, is to interpret the statute to have it keep up with the changes in technology.
But shouldn't we leave that to the legislature to write? They've written what they've written. Either it covers it or it doesn't. Shouldn't we leave that to the legislature to write as developments occur, as they've done?
And that's right, and the court certainly could hold that. But it does not seem a very far stretch. In fact, it doesn't seem a stretch virtually at all to read into 151.001 the ability to say that this statute should control in this kind of situation. The public policy here is very strong. If you ask most people about this case, the first thing that they say is, oh, Don McGill wants to be the dad. Why not let him be the dad? But the minute you flip the circumstance and you say, hey, what had happened? What would you think if he did not want to have parental rights, and Mildred were asking him to provide financial support? Almost all of those same people would say, no, that's not fair, that's not right.
Well, next question. What is the law? Let's assume again that none of these statutes really capture the situation. There was the same oral agreement that you allege was reached, and now the former wife wants to renege on that agreement. She says, look, this is his child, and I need financial support. Would that oral agreement be binding on her such that she could not get financial support for the child?
Yes. I think yes. It has
and
to
and
be.
Where do we, how do we, how do we separate that out from the family code, separate and apart from the in vitro and the artificial insemination statute?
Well, I understand you can separate it out from the code itself, but I don't think that from a policy standpoint you can separate it out from what happened here, and that this is a different type of situation. When people have intercourse and produce a baby, then under those circumstances, the only thing you can be sure of is that they intended to have intercourse. But if people, if a baby is produced through artificial means, through the assisted conception, then in that circumstance, the purpose is to produce a baby. And that is such a fundamental difference in how you get to the baby. It seems to me that it's appropriate from a policy reason for there to be at that point where the woman is inseminated or whenever she receives the artificial embryo, that there be some certainty.
How do we decide policy when there are statutes on the books? I mean, you're asking us to ignore, assuming that the in vitro and the artificial insemination statutes don't control, aren't you asking us to ignore other statutes that are on the books?
Well, I don't think that they apply any more precisely to this situation than the ones under the assisted conception statute. They're just different. That this type of situation is different.
We're dealing with frozen embryos, and they could, I suppose, last an indeterminate length of time.
We don't know how long, roughly.
It seems to me there was a Tennessee case from several years ago involving frozen embryos, and one of the follow-up pieces of information was that the laboratory would put up the frozen embryos for adoption. Is there anything in the record in this case that indicates what this laboratory does if frozen embryos aren't used by the biological donors?
Well, there was a form, and that is in the record, that Mildred and Don filled out at the time that the embryos were created, and the lab requires you to check off which one of those options that you're, how the embryo is supposed to be disposed of. And in that, there was a check off on that, and my recollection was that that it would be determined later. I can't remember exactly what the disposal was, but there was a form.
So there was already, did that form comply with the family code for parental consent to an adoption?
Not as far as I know. Now, to an adoption?
Well, I guess the point is, if the family code says that you can't relinquish parental rights until after the birth, how does that affect any forms that you execute with a frozen embryo where the embryo may be implanted years later with some other host, maybe adoption? And how does the family code even think about how they do that?
Apparently not.
So it's just silent on those issues.
I think that's right, and that's part of the problem that we have in this entire case is that there's nothing specific. The most specific thing that we can find is under the assisted conception statutes. The logical place to look to answer your question, if I were a first-year law student and somebody gave me that assignment, go find it in the family code, the place that I think any of us would look would be under the assisted conception subsection, but it doesn't address the questions that you raise.
Ms. Liberato, how does this informed consent form fit into your analysis, your statutory analysis of the assisted conception provisions when the form, in fact, provided that these frozen embryos belonged to both parents and that it took both parents' consent to dispose of them? In the event of divorce, that this particular couple checked the fact that they would be disposed of according to both of their wishes.
Both agreed.
So what we've got is it looks like an agreement with these people in which they are both keeping an interest, even post-divorce, in what happens to these embryos.
Right, I understand. And as you say, what happened is they checked both places according to the wishes of the mother, according to the wishes of the father, and then both agree. But it's really...
But how do we apply... You ask us to apply a statute that then puts the father out of the picture.
Right.
How does that statute then interplay with this particular document that is entirely contrary to it?
I don't think it is entirely contrary. What that document is really an agreement to agree later on. It's not an agreement between the parties. In fact, what it really is an agreement with the lab and directs the lab what's going to happen. But even assuming you don't agree with that, it doesn't have the specificity to me to be enforceable. But not only that, it just doesn't look like an agreement. It's an agreement to agree.
We have a disposition of the embryo in this case.
Right, that's true.
And does your client agree that the disposition was in accordance with the wishes of both the former wife and former husband? And that was the implantation of the embryo? So in fact, we have a disposition and it is in accordance with what both parties wanted.
If you can read it that way.
Well, I mean, is that what our record shows happened in this case? Is that something the parties agree upon? That the disposition of the embryo was the wishes of both parties.
They just disagree as to what those wishes are.
Well, but what does disposition mean? The disposition is it the implantation, destruction, giving to another an infertile couple? Is the disposition means the actual act of what happens to the embryo?
That's right.
And the parties in this case both agreed to the implantation.
And I see your point. In fact, they do.
That's right, they do.
They both agree to the implantation. What isn't covered in the agreement is what the parental rights are going to be. And that's really the issue in the case. It's not that the embryo is going to be used. And they did agree, that's correct. They did agree that she would be allowed to implant that embryo inside her in the hopes that it would become a baby, and of course it didn't. But the next step beyond what that agreement is, the disposition, is what are the parental rights of the parents.
And if the donor statutes don't apply, then the family code will govern that question.
The family code will govern that question if it's in the family code, but in fact, I don't see it in the family code and general principles of contract law.
Well, why doesn't the family code apply? It talks about paternity. It doesn't make a distinction between embryonic or how the child was delivered or created. Why doesn't the code apply by its plain terms?
The section that says
the paternity, acknowledgement of paternity by the father before it was amended, which would be the one that would apply here, correct?
Well, the acknowledgement of paternity, and you're right, you know, that's been rescinded, but all that does is create a rebuttable presumption. And that they're the parent, that's right.
What is there to rebut that presumption that he's not the parent?
That there's a difference between being a biological parent and being a parent. If that weren't the case, there'd be no such thing as an adoption. And so the distinction is that we have created, yes, it is a rebuttable presumption. Our response to that is if you don't agree with us that the statutes apply, then the second level of that is we've rebutted it because we have an agreement.
Agreement
based on the fact that there
parental
is an
rights, not that he's not a parent.
Not that he's not a biological father.
And your agreement, you concede on parental rights, is unenforceable.
Our agreement on parental rights is not unenforceable. It just hasn't been determined by a jury what that agreement should be.
Ms. Liberato, if we're in an area where this statutes are not clear. You say we don't have anything that really covers this kind of situation. And these kind of disputes, should courts also determine what's in the best interest of the child?
Well, I don't think best interest is an issue in this case.
Are those that interest is reflected in the statutes passed by the legislature? Or how is that?
It is in some instances, but best interest is an issue whenever custody is the issue, and custody is not the issue. If best interest were always the determination, then, in an adoptive situation, if a biological parent came back and wanted to assert parental rights over an adopted child, would you ask the court, or would it be appropriate for the court to determine what's in the best interest of the child, whether to stay with his or her adopted parents or to go with the biological parent? There are just situations where, although it seems counterintuitive, that there are broader issues that are involved than that, and issues that fundamentally are in the best interest, but that's not the test of best interest of the child. So that's a long way of answering your question, but the bottom line is best interest would apply if this were a custody case. This is not a custody case. It's a determination of parental rights, and Mr. McGill has no parental rights. Therefore, best interest is an issue.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Bond.
May it please the court, Mr. Roy Moore and Mr. John Robertson will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Moore will open with the first 16 minutes.
Your Honors, our position is very, very simple. When a husband and wife provide sperm and egg and create, during marriage, an embryo, a pregnant egg, if you will, they both have parenting rights and obligations. And at a minimum, I think most of the justices have hit on this, a minimum, any change in their parenting rights and obligations must only be done in writing.
But you can do it in writing?
Must be done in writing for policy, Your Honor.
So I'll understand your position.
Sure, Your Honor.
If this agreement had been in writing, it'd be enforceable.
I don't think so, Your Honor, very truthfully. I do think this, that if this agreement had been in writing and had been approved by a court of competent jurisdiction, or had Mrs. McGill, Smith, or Barrett, or Mildred, if I may, been given the rights to these children at their divorce, to these frozen embryos at their divorce. Mr. McGill, who was not represented by counsel at divorce, but did sign an agreed decree. Your Honor, yes, we wouldn't be here. She had the right to do that. And in fact, there is a writing.
That decree would give them to one spouse or another as property, or how would it divide
them? Do it as property according to the Tennessee case that one of the justices asked about, I believe, which was not done in Tennessee. It was found to be property that was not disposed of in Tennessee after divorce, and then the judge says, no, ma'am, you can't have this frozen embryo inserted into your womb, thereby forcing Junior Davis, I believe it was, to be the father and pay child support. The property, if you will, was given to Junior Davis. Junior Davis, I believe, immediately took the frozen embryo, had them destroyed so that he wouldn't have this obligation that certainly Mr. McGill has stepped up to the plate and wants. There is a writing, though, in the informed consent pre-embryo psycho, and I can't pronounce it, preservation form, that there were questions asked about where it said, according to the wishes of the wife and according to the wishes of the husband. On the very next page, which is signed both by Mrs. McGill and Mr. McGill, in the first paragraph, we understand we retain the right to change out decisions in this regard until the time that a pre-embryo is thawed, when it's implanted into the woman's uterus. Such right shall be executed by giving written notice to the assisted reproductive technology laboratory team, and such notice shall specifically provide for alternative alternate disposition. Nobody, it is uncontroverted, nobody said they ever gave any kind of writing. To answer your question, Judge, even if there had been a writing without court approval, no disposition in divorce, I'm not sure what the law would be. I think it should be up to the legislature to say. No one can say that 151-101 applies here.
Do you think, had these people never been married, do you think those, would 151-101 and or its progeny apply? Or the
whole not where you have a frozen embryo. Had
that's
you
my
had
question.
Artificial insemination, yes, sir. 151A, I believe, says that if husband and wife agree in writing that, and they don't have any rights as parents, and I have to really look at it because I'm not the world's best at remembering exact wording. 151-101, entitled artificial insemination. If a husband consents to the artificial insemination of his wife, any resulting child is a child of both of them. The consent must be in writing and must be acknowledged. B, if a woman is artificially inseminated, the resulting child is not the child of the donor unless he is the husband.
Why would you require court approval for in vitro fertilization under these circumstances, but not for artificial insemination under the statute?
Actually, Judge, this is a statute.
Yes.
Passed by the legislature.
I'm aware of that.
And there is no statute.
I'm slow, but I'm aware of that.
I understand. There is no statute on it. And the
I'm aware of that. But what I'm asking you is a different question, which is, why would you do it differently in the different circumstances? Why would you have court approval in one circumstance, but a written agreement be sufficient in another?
Because of statute. We fulfill a number of obligations, even though we do not believe it was really necessary. I think our briefs cover it completely. The presumption of parents. Now, Mr. McGill, there's no argument that the definition of a parent is the person who contributes, who is the father, contributes the sperm to impregnate the egg. He signed an agreement that allows his name to be placed as a father on the birth certificate.
Where in the record can we find that?
Judge, it is not in the record because we couldn't get it. We asked for it.
How can we consider your off-the-record statement?
Because he swore to it, Judge, that he did sign it in his affidavit, and in his statement of paternity, the affidavit, which is attached to his statement of paternity, and we did file an action to establish his paternity, and Mrs. Smith, no place ever contradicted that pursuant to the family code. It was never done.
Mr. Moore, I'm sorry.
Go
ahead. I thought you
were
finished.
I was.
Are you saying there's a separate document that Mr. McGill signed that says, I consented in writing to be named as the child's father on the child's birth certificate?
Yes, Your Honor. It's attached as an affidavit to his...
Well, I know he makes that statement, but I'm asking you, is there an exact piece of paper that would corroborate that sworn statement?
That is correct, Your Honor.
But it's not in the record.
It is not in the record because we can't get it pursuant to state law, except for child support questions. The health and safety code specifically provides for it, which we cite.
I have a hard time seeing the relevance of invoking these presumptions of parentage if it's admitted that he's the biological father.
I agree with you, Judge. I don't see any reason for it either because presumptions are admitted to prove something that's not admitted. It's admitted. We did everything, dotted every I and dot type, crossed every T in an effort to try to show the court that he was the father, that he should have parental rights, that they weren't terminated.
Yes, sir. But your opponent says nobody disputes the fact that Mr. McGill is the biological father. Her viewpoint is, be that as it may, he can't be a parent because he can't fit into that category for the reasons she articulates. And so when we're looking at 51002, that whole section has to do with is or is not a person the biological father, not whether they are the parent under her view of this case. So why is it or is Mr. McGill the parent under with an acknowledged concession he is the biological father?
First thing, they said 02 and 03 do not even apply. So we didn't really address that.
So we agree then?
Yes, sir.
Doesn't apply. Why is he a parent then?
He is a parent because of the presumptions, because he was.
No, every one of these presumptions has to do with whether he's a biological father, if you're trying to equate that. What presumptions are you saying exist that he's a parent?
She acknowledged he was herself by having his name placed on the birth certificate, for one. For two, that he has shown the interest that all of the court cases say is necessary to do, and that he was the husband at the time of the fertilization of the egg.
So then there is an important aspect of the case based on when the pre-embryo was formed and when it was actually inserted. That makes a difference in your view.
Not when it was actually inserted, because he was the husband when the
egg was inserted. And in your view, that makes a difference, because he was not the husband when it was inserted. And he was not the husband within 300 days of the birth of that child.
We never said he was.
I know that, but,
yes,
but that's why that statute doesn't apply.
Yes, that is true. And
well, is your whole argument then based on the fact that they were husband and wife at the time of the formation of the embryo at the clinic?
No, sir, that's not my whole argument. That's part of my argument. I believe it's an extremely important part of the argument. But it also, we simply have her acquiescence again. And the Court of Appeals, I believe, looked to that she put his name on the birth certificate and the number of points that the Court of Appeals did do.
Well,
and
you could I don't say that I agree with this or not, but you could say her view of what the agreement was, that he was relinquishing all parental rights, doesn't make any difference if she puts his name on the birth certificate as the biological father.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, she's distinguishing between biological father and what that means under the law and what being a parent means, that you've got two different ways that you connect with the child, and that, yes, he's a biological father, but in her view, he gave up all his parental rights.
What she is asking the court to do is to terminate unilaterally his parental rights.
No, she says he agreed to it. I know you say that's not true. So why don't we try the issue of which side of the agreement is right and let a jury decide on the credibility of the two parties?
Because there's no material fact that the parties are in disagreement on. And
well, you don't agree with her that he said, I terminate all my parental rights to this child.
No, sir. I think that if he did it, he had to do it in writing. Had he said it in writing, had it been done in writing.
You have to concede, we said it, but you can't enforce it unless it's in writing. But you've never said that. You have disputed the agreement from the day one.
Yes, sir. I have disputed the agreement, but had it been in writing, summary judgment would not have been the appropriate remedy. It would have then had to go, I think, to the jury. The reason it didn't go to the jury, one reason, is it wasn't in writing, that she says, and it makes no difference what she says or what he said. It makes no difference at all whether they had a conversation concerning this embryo, because it wasn't in writing, and public policy absolutely dictates that something of this magnitude would have to be
around. Let me ask you again about that. If it were in writing and it was her side, the writing recited, she says, I don't want to do this unless I'm going to have full control of this child. You're not going to have any interest in it. That's the only way I want to do it. He says, I understand that. I agree to that. It's no problem. I just don't want to be on the hook for it. And that's their agreement. Signed, sworn to, complete. Then the outcome of this case would be what?
Summary judgment should not lie. It could be a trial on the fact question there of whether or not he should participate and whether or not then under contractual law the agreement was good or could be enforced. And I think really and truly,
how does that agreement comport with the requirements of the Family Code for relinquishment of parental rights?
I don't think that it does. This is not our situation here. I can't tell you what we would have done for sure had it been as the justice asked.
Should, as a matter of public policy, this court recognize that under these circumstances, a biological father can give up their parental rights at that point in time?
My opinion, no.
And why not?
Because I think that should be left up to the legislature.
All right. And then what about if we take that back one step further? What if on this informed consent that both parties signed and where they were talking about what the disposition would be in the event of divorce, they had signed donated to another infertile couple? Does that have the legal effect under Texas law of them giving up all of their parental rights, or could they later on come back if they did donate the embryo and it was used by another couple? Where does Texas law stand on that issue?
There's no Texas law on it, Your Honor.
Well, if we go with the idea that as a matter of public policy, we will not accept an agreement as your opponent is promoting in this case, how far back in time do we go before we can say, yes, it's okay to enforce giving up parental rights when we have an embryo that has been created via in vitro fertilization?
I think it has to be a question for the legislature. Now, I can address it analogously. If, in fact, Mrs. McGill had said, I'm going to raise the child, and Mr. McGill says, I'm going to pay the support, first verdict. And 17 years down the road, as we see, or I'm
Attorney General's office very often coming in and saying, you owe child support for the back. Wait a minute, she said that I don't have to pay. The courts, the district courts are all saying, I don't care what she said. That wasn't approved by a court. If the legislature passes legislation that says, yes, they can do certain things, then that's going to have to be put up to the constitutional muster, I would believe.
Well, I understand. The purpose of my question is you're asking us not to enforce this purported oral agreement. And I'm asking, what are the consequences of buying your argument that we should not enforce this agreement on other circumstances, other facts? For example, the circumstance where a donation of a frozen embryo may be made to another couple. What are the implications of our accepting your argument that we should not enforce this agreement?
I think you'll force the legislature to pass some laws. Secondly, I don't think there'll be any consequence. I don't think you'll ever see this case in this situation ever again, where you have husband and wife, and the specifics of this situation.
Well, let me ask you, Ms. Moore, on that. Ms. Liberato raises the question that if this egg had been implanted in Ms. McGill, and then the semen had been placed in Ms. McGill, and then the embryo created, that we'd have a different result. Do you agree?
That's artificial insemination, yes, Your Honor.
Agree. Even if the semen came from the ex-husband.
Yes, sir.
And even if it came from the ex-husband before they were divorced. It was here and here, and they just both and frozen, and then a couple of years later, they all got together, and they agreed, you can go ahead and use my semen and use your egg, and we'll implant it. As long as they do the implant in the mother directly as opposed to in a Petri dish, the result's different.
I don't know what would happen. I don't think, Your Honor, that I think you'd have a different result because technically the definition of artificial insemination comes into play in 151.001, talks to that. Does not speak to in vitro fertilization.
So if the insemination happens in the uterus, then that's covered. But if it happens in a Petri dish, then it's the standard old family code that provides that you gotta give your consents and all that after the baby's born.
I believe that is true, Judge. I don't know.
And ultimately, that's the decision in this court. If it happens in the uterus, the biological father doesn't have parental rights. If it happens in a Petri dish, the biological father has parental rights.
I happen to disagree with that because of the biological father's sperm being introduced to the woman's, to the wife's egg in the uterus versus the Petri dish. I think it's a different situation that, first of all, it's not going to happen. I think we have to look at public policy on things that are going to happen. And we have the very specific situation here that the code does not apply to. And it's not a question that this court, I believe, has been asked to find. It's been asked to affirm the appellate court, who affirmed the summary judgment, finding that he was the father. And a trial was then had, and he was given rights. I can't tell you what your decisions or decision will have in far-reaching situations.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
Professor Roberts, I'm going to speak, or are we going to have a rebuttal?
No,
Professor,
would you like to hear me?
It's up to you. I just wasn't sure in time.
Well, if it pleases the court, our time has run out. Perhaps I could just address a couple issues. I first do want to point out that the legislature has handled the question of embryo donation, 151.103, where it would allow the donation to to terminate the rights of the couple.
Only to a married couple, not to a single woman.
Right, only to a married couple.
It doesn't cover the situation where a donated embryo is planted in a single woman.
No, it would not cover that, but it would cover a donation from anyone who created the embryo to a married couple where the owner of the embryo would have their parental rights terminated. I wanted to just briefly address the constitutional issues raised in the petitioner's brief. I think there is no constitutional bar in this case to following Texas law for termination of parental rights after birth, that failure to enforce an oral agreement, a pre-birth oral agreement for assigning rearing rights and duties in
so
offspring.
You disagree with your co-counsel's position?
I don't think we disagree on that. I'm just
addressing
the constitutional issue.
I understood your co-counsel to say that if there were a written agreement rather than an oral agreement, summary judgment would have been improper. And do I take what you're saying now to be that that would not be?
I understood him to say that if there were a written agreement, we would still have to follow Texas law. And Texas law concerning termination of parental rights would not give effect to that at the present time. And I would simply want to make the point.
So you would say summary judgment would be proper?
And I just want to make the point that there would be no constitutional bar. There'd be no constitutional bar to refusing to recognize an oral agreement. Nothing the Supreme Court has ever held has extended to the right to make a pre-birth assignment of rearing rights and duties. The court's cases in this area have focused mostly on and the avoidance of reproduction while there's recognition of a right to procreate by intercourse. There's never been a recognition of a fundamental right to engage in non-coital reproduction, much less a right to assign rearing rights and duties in frozen embryos by contract ahead of birth. And it's extremely unlikely, given the Supreme Court's current reluctance to find new fundamental rights, that it would find that there is such a fundamental right here that would have to be recognized. If it did, by some chance, recognize such a right, certainly not be an absolute right. It would simply be a right against unwarranted governmental intrusion in these areas. And it certainly would not be unwarranted for a state to require that such pre-birth termination be done in writing or by some other procedure that made sure that the parties were well aware of the momentous impact of what they were doing. Indeed, if such a procedure in writing were similar matter were not followed, there'd be a problem with infringing on the father's constitutional rights to rear a child. Perhaps if this right were recognized, he could waive it in advance, but such a waiver would have to be done in a knowing and intelligent way, such as by writing.
Are you asserting that your client has constitutional rights? That the position that the petitioner is urging here violates your client's constitutional rights.
Yes, we would assert that that a pre-birth agreement that is not in writing or that is not otherwise shown to have been a knowing and intelligent waiver of a father's right to rear his biologic children after birth would violate his right to rear.
But that's recognized. Not in your briefs in the trial court or the court of appeals.
Right.
And it's not in her briefs in the trial court.
You're not really urging it. You're not effectively urging it.
No, she has raised in her briefs.
When the chief asked you, you're arguing. We want it clear that you're not. That's not in your briefing papers before the trial court or the court.
No, it's not. It's only been in response to the
haven't
supplemental
you pointed out
by the petition. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Haven't you also pointed out rather forcibly that the other side can't raise the constitutional
issues?
Yes. They do for the same reasons that you can't do it here.
Exactly. I'm just here to respond that if the constitutional issue.
Well, we will a little bit further.
I withdraw my question. Any other question? Any non-constitutional?
Thank you very much.
May I please the court? Mr. Earl Lilly will present the rebuttal for the petitioner.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I could impose, in view of all the questions asked, a perhaps somewhat simplistically stated question about this case and perhaps answering Justice O'Neill's question as to biological parenting, who are parents, etc. And simply state this, if it be an admission, so be it, that outside of the area of assisted conception, outside of that, there is no parent that can unilaterally terminate their obligations of the parent or their rights of the parent.
Okay.
Now other areas.
Let me follow up with that, which is my initial question. Having made that statement, if we find the assisted conception statutes do not apply, do you concede that that agreement would be unenforceable?
I don't concede that, but I do concede this. I do concede that if you do not take this case and view this case as assisted conception, aside from the assisted conception statutes, this is an assisted conception. If you say that this is no different than the traditional biological way of having children when they didn't do it that way in this case, then I concede. But I urge this court to answer the question of what in the heck is assisted conception all about if it's not the opposite or extension of something other than biological reproduction in the traditional way.
But if the legislature has not chosen at this point in time to include a circumstance such as this within the assisted conception statutory scheme, then what position does that leave this court in?
I don't accept that premise. I accept the premise of RC that we've cited in our papers, that the courts should seek to promote part of the statute and not simply the letter of the law, and that the courts should always try to comply with the letter as well as the spirit of the law, and then look to one.
Aren't we first bound by the language of the law?
I believe we're bound by the language of the law, but yeah, I don't believe
you're not taking the position. You're taking the position that only 151.101 applies in this case.
I believe only 1101, as far as assisted conception word for word, can apply in this case.
Okay, so we are not asking us to look at 102 or 103.
I'm not asking you to look at 102 or 103 because, in my heart and in my professionalism, I don't believe it applies. I believe it's a different, completely different cases. But it's 101B that applies, that answers in part the difference between conception and a petri dish, and I hope this doesn't go too far, or not too far, a far-reaching statement, or insemination by semen in the uterus. It says if a woman is artificially inseminated, the resulting child is not the child of the donor unless he is the husband. If the woman is artificially inseminated, and I take that to mean, and hope that it means, that we're not talking about a petri dish, we're talking about insemination and the resulting birth after the fact.
But there's a fundamental difference between the two procedures. With artificial insemination, it occurs immediately. It doesn't contemplate a frozen embryo that could go on for years and years. So with that fundamental difference between the procedures, how can we rely on the statute?
Well, I agree that there's a fundamental difference because it's a physical difference, but I don't agree that there's a fundamental difference.
Well, there's a time difference as well, which is pretty significant. I mean, I agree that if you just term it in terms of joining sperm and egg, there's not a difference, but there's a huge time differential here.
And I believe that, Justice O'Neill, that time difference weighs in Millery's favor and not in the opposite. I ask this court to answer the question as they explore the far-reaching effects of this case.
But let me follow up on what Justice O'Neill said. Because there's a timing difference with that, doesn't it make it even harder to accept your viewpoint that we should interpret artificial insemination to be the same thing as in vitro fertilization? Since artificial insemination occurs at a particular point in time, and the actual fertilization in the in vitro process can occur at a much earlier point in time.
Your Honor, if this court finds that the fertilization of the egg in the petri dish, the court finds that that is indeed the same result as if they were married and stayed married and ultimately had the baby, Mildred loses. I submit the question that I tried to ask before. What if McGill and Schmidt clearly agreed in writing that he would have no parental rights nor parental obligations? Clearly. There is nothing in the RC case, and there is nothing in the Cass case, the only cases of Supreme Courts that touch on the facts similar to this case, that talk about agreements in writing. They talk about the agreements. How in on earth can Mildred Schmidt get the benefits of equal protection under the Constitution of this country, having a child as a single parent, if she could not agree that they could not agree to what they in fact agreed to?
Well,
no,
How does that argument fit with the fact that they both signed a form that indicated that they both owned the frozen embryos and both were required to consent to the disposition of the embryos?
I don't believe, and I've looked at the form upside and downside. I don't believe it says that. It simply is ambiguous as to how the embryos should be disposed of.
But look at the sentence just before that, I believe, where it talks about them both recognizing that they both possess or own, I don't have it right in front of me, the embryos. How does that square with what you're talking about?
Well, I think you have an ambiguity as to the future. There's no ambiguity that Mildred had the right to use the embryo.
We have been advised that each pre-embryo resulting from the fertilization of the woman's ovum by the man's sperm shall be the joint possession of both. As the owners of any and all such pre-embryos, the consent of both parents will be required concerning the use or disposition. How does that square with the way you're asking us to interpret the section of the assisted conception statute?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that the two are synonymous. I mean, they're completely different issues. One is the right to have the embryo and use the embryo. The other is the parenting rights or the parental rights of the agreement of the people that were not married when implantation occurred. I cannot answer the question myself as I go down the illogical end of this thing in assisted conception, just the concept of that, and go down 10 years or 15 years later and come back with a piece of paper to Mr. McGill and say, when he's 75 or 80 years old or whatever the age is, had different families, different facts, different circumstances, and say, you're the proud father of a baby child, and for the next 18 years you'll pay child support and have parental obligations, etc. It makes little sense, and I submit that those are the reasons that the agreements control in assisted conception statutes.
And all they would have had to have done to avoid that is to have that made part of the divorce decree.
They didn't do that.
They didn't do that. And the statute covers it for people who aren't married. This is sort of an unusual situation.
I believe had it clearly been covered in the divorce decree, we wouldn't be here arguing right now because the agreements would control. They would be dispositive of a property right, and I don't want to get into that issue, but the embryo was an embryo, a frozen embryo at the time of the divorce. It wasn't until 3 months later that it was implanted and other rights began to occur, arguably. There's an agreement. They both say there's an agreement, but they don't agree on what the agreement was. And as I get through this thing, I wanted to, at some point, review the only thing that I could find that made sense to me under this particular circumstance. Please.
Is this the answer to a question?
Yes. I'm sorry.
Judge Warren's question.
Yeah, go ahead and finish.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to read you. I'll answer the question. I want
please
to read the closing Supreme Court result in that Cass case of a few years back, talking about the uncertainties inherent in the IVF process itself are vastly complicated by cryopreservation, which extends the viability of it indefinitely and allows for minds and circumstances to change. These factors make it particularly important that the court seek to honor the party's expression of choice before disputes erupt, with the party's overall direction of utmost importance kept in mind. That's the key ingredient in this case, that the rights of McGill came through assisted conception, his rights, through assisted conception and agreements made in connection with assisted conception, because you can't make agreements if it weren't an assisted conception case. You can't say I'm not going to be liable other than by going through court procedures and things like that. So I urge this court, if in fact and indeed his rights came through assisted conception, it's 101B that controls, and if indeed he was a sperm donor, the fact that he was a husband at the time of the donation of the sperm should not be controlled.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in today's causes, and the marshal will adjourn.
All rise.